box office top 10 this week. At number 10, It's All Gone Pete Tong.
Number 10 is that?
Number 10.
That's
yes.
number 10, so that'll yes. be going out of the top 10 next week because it is absolutely disgracefully bad. And the only thing, I mean, I know I said this before, but I bet you that Paul Kay, who, you know, used to make a living as Dennis Pennis insulting people like Hugh Grant, I bet you he's feeling bad about ever having called Hugh Grant wooden, because on the strength of this one-note performance, it's like, I'm sorry, there you go. You can go around calling Hugh Grant wooden all you like. When you get in front of the camera yourself, you've got to do better than just shriek and fall over.
The Hitchhiker's Guide at number 9.
It's, you know, it is what it is. It isn't what I wanted it to be. It is what everybody else apparently wanted it to be, so that's absolutely fine.
Kingdom of Heaven, number 8.
Big, sprawling, messy, all over the place, and Orlando Bloom cannot carry the, you know, the weight of the Crusades. However, as always with any Ridley Scott movie, it's, you know, it's not a total failure. There is stuff worth seeing in there. It is a long ride, and you definitely do sort of feel that, you know, your head goes with it, but your bum gives up about halfway through. But it is worth seeing so that you can have the discussion afterwards. And I do think he's tried to do an interesting, you know, post-September the 11th movie.
Millions at 7.
Great, fantastic. Danny Boyle makes the film that it's okay for you to take your kids to. Oh, the only thing I would say about it is they have to be slightly more grown-up kids. It's a 12A certificate. And I am with the BBFC on this. The BBFC complained for a long time that 12A did not mean bring your 6-year-old. It meant it's suitable for 12-year-olds unless you really think that somebody slightly shy of 12 may be able to do it with parental assistance. It doesn't mean, hey, you know, it's a weekend, take a 6-year-old. You have to be a fairly grown-up kid to understand it. But if you are, and if you're somebody who likes, for example, the more grown-up end of Roald Dahl, then I think it's terrific.
House of Wax at 6?
You know, not as bad as it could be. Certainly of all the Dark Castle remakes, it's one of the better ones, largely due to the fact that there is a gory and gratuitous scene in which Paris Hilton, you know, gets her just deserves. And there is a fantastic ending in which, because it's not House of Wax, it's Town of Wax. I mean, I know the title is House of Wax, but it's only really connected to House of Wax, you know, by the title. And just to see whether you even remember, the most important thing about House of Wax, which started off with Mystery of the Wax Museum in the 1930s, was remade in the 1950s by André de Toth in 3D. And André de Toth famously...
had measles?
No, you're just doing this to annoy me now, aren't you? You do know what it is. Have you really forgotten?
Oh,
it's filmed in 3D by a director who famously had one eye.
A hat.
Okay, fine. No, that's it. Fine. He had one eye. That by the time that gag works, it'll be out of the top 10.
Do it again in about 3 weeks and see if I've remembered.
Right. Did you really not remember? You just okay.
I'm just concentrating. There's so many things to look at.
All right.
Monster in Law at 5, starring Jane Fonda, my friend from last week. If you'd been here and not taken time off with your family, you'd have been in.
I did listen. I did ring in, incidentally, with my verdict on the movies you review, which I noticed you shuffled over whilst
your
new best friend, Jason, you and him were getting on fine. Thank you.
League of Gentlemen's
Monster in Law, which I didn't do. Not very good, and I don't think Jane should have returned to the screen for it, even though I do think she was a legend and it was, you know, and all that stuff.
Just as well you're not here, then. Mm-hmm. League of Gentlemen's Apocalypse at 4.
You did review this last week. I mean, I feel less warmly towards it than he does. I think it's a mess. I think it's an ambitious mess. And there are things in it that I really, really wanted to like. But it does prove that in the end, it's a TV joke. And although they've done this whole big thing about it's the characters from the TV series desperate to get back into the real world by attacking the real world. Just, you know, you can't half an hour and you think, okay, you've now done all the hair lip jokes. You know, there's a character called Hair Lip and he just speaks in double entendres and it's fine. And after 29 minutes, I had enough of it and it's just not enough laughs.
Pacifier at number 3.
Not enough laughs. I mean, Vin Diesel looks after the kids. And you know the key gag is? He does the baby's nappy and he goes, ooh. And you go, yeah, that's really funny, Vin. And where are you going to go from here? Because it's not Kindergarten Cop. It's not what Schwarzenegger did with his career with Kindergarten Cop. And Schwarzenegger's first language wasn't even American. So, you know, the fact that Schwarzenegger actually did manage to have a comedy career and then went on to make a movie in which he was a mother in Junior, in which he got pregnant by Emma Thompson.
Before I do the number 2, this from Arthur, who says, Mark says he didn't review Alexander because he was away. Teachers don't settle for this argument regarding homework. So, has he seen Sin City, which is this week's number 2?
Yeah, I have, yeah. It's interesting. On the subject of Alexander, incidentally, the Alexander Director's Cut DVD is coming in the next week, so you will get an Alexander review next week. So I am now going to watch it in the Director's Cut, which Oliver Stone says is better. As far as Sin City is concerned, looks absolutely fantastic, definitely bridges the gap between the comic book and the big screen, is a huge sort of step forward in that way. It is completely heartless and completely soulless, but so what? It's a comic book adaptation, and I've read a couple of people got particularly sort of bothered by the amorality of it, or the immorality of it. And I think, well, look, it's a comic book adaptation. It is absolutely the triumph of style over substance. The style is fantastic. When a movie looks this good, perhaps who cares? It's not like it has an offensive substance. It has no substance at all. And it is too long. Roger Corman would have cut 30 minutes out of it, and it would have been a better movie. But it's Mickey Rourke's best performance in a very, very long time. And, you know, it's visually stunning.
And the UK box office number one is, of course, Star Wars, The Revenge of the Sith.
You know,
you don't need to say
no. It's just don't. And listen, and George, if you're listening, we don't need 7 to 9.
Okay, so the review's coming up, and also the Aviator competition. So all the best, and maybe some of the indifferent films coming up with Mark Kermode. And your review's welcome. By the way, of course, just a reminder, we have told you the last couple of weeks, you can iPod this whole thing. You can podcast Mark's movie reviews every week. You can download them onto your computer and carry them around in your back pocket. All the details, or in your front pocket, or your handbag, whatever. All the details on the 5Live website. And I think you're doing rather well.
Am I?
Thousands and thousands. You're only being beaten, I think, in BBC figures by the entire Beethoven cycle on Radio 3.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay, well,
if you're going to be second to something, be
exactly.
Second to Beethoven. That's not too
very
bad.
Very good. Me and Ludwig van.
You can text 85058 5Live.
Because he couldn't hear it anyway.
Don't
sorry,
interrupt
sorry,
when I'm
sorry,
cueing
sorry,
the news.
Sorry.
You'll learn about this one day. 5Live, 3:30. I'm probably asking the wrong person here, Mark.
Go on.
But the Return of the Jedi was being watched in our house.
Yeah.
Muppets in Space, as you always call it.
It is.
Right at the very end, right?
You see the two of them dancing, and who's the guy who's acting Darth Vader, and are they going to replace him with the new guy?
Well, no, actually. Well, the version I'm watching, it's Anakin Skywalker.
Yeah, exactly. At the very, very
and
end.
It looks like Hayden Christensen.
No, I don't think it is Hayden Christensen, because I think it's the version on the DVD. Have you been given an email that covers this? Basically, I have recently got to the end of Return of the Jedi exactly the same, and at the end you see... your man, you know,
Hayden Christensen.
Yeah, and your other guy who's died, you know,
Obi-Wan and Yoda.
Yeah, but it's not Hayden Christensen. I don't think. I think it is. I mean, listen, I may be wrong, and I have to say, if I'm going to be wrong on trivia about anything, I'm very proud to be wrong on Star Wars. I did look at it and think, I wonder who that is, and then I thought, you know, what's going to have to happen is that George is going to have to go back and digitally put Hayden Christensen into it because that's what he does. He digitally fixes them. So has he already done it?
No, I don't.
No,
think
it is
so.
Somebody
I think,
else.
I think it's someone else. We'll sort that out in the next.
With a sort of mid-70s or mid-80s kind of haircut. It looks like, yeah. So, but I'm sure George will go back and diddle with it again, as he always does, on the assumption that if you put more CGI onto the films, people will stop noticing that the script is really, really bad.
Okay, well, according to this, just arrived.
Just in.
Sebastian Shaw.
Fine.
English actor from Norfolk. Plays Anakin Skywalker in Star Wars Episode 6.
Yeah, but all he does is stands there in slightly fuzzy...
And Return of the Jedi. Yeah, that's the whole point. Anyway, that's...
Return of the Jedi is Star Wars 6.
Yeah, I know. So he's in... He's in
Return of the Jedi. That's it. That is number 6.
He is in Return of the Jedi. And according to this, he's Sebastian Shaw. But he looks like Hayden Christensen. I wish
he
I'd
doesn't look. He just looks like a guy with a... He looks like the guy out of, you know, Dollar. That's what he looks like. He was slightly darker hair, wearing that sort of, you know...
David Van Day.
David Van Day with
and
the
kind
of neuromantic
tattoo. Is that Bizarre next to him? No, it's Obi-Wan Kenobi.
Yes.
Of the movies out this week, sorry I even started.
You've done those.
What should we go and see?
Okay, do you want to set the Aviators competition?
In a minute.
Okay, fine. Let's start with Mr. and Mrs. Smith. It's summer. So now the summer blockbuster season is here with us, and that means, you know, movies that cost absolutely billions are high concept. High concept is an idea that was kind of, well, to the best of my knowledge, was first really pioneered by Steven Spielberg. And it's this whole thing about if you could, you know, the best movies are movies that you can describe in 25 words, so they can be pitched to the studio in 25 words, and the studio that can then pitch them to the audience in 25 words. So, in the case of Mr. and Mrs. Smith, Brad and Angelina are undercover assassins, both of whom discover that the other is an undercover assassin attempting to kill them. That's it. That's basically it. And that's probably like 21, 22. So fine. There we go. $110 million. Go off and enjoy yourself. Doug Liman, who was the director who originally was like a character actor director, directed Swingers, which I like very much, and Go, which I like quite a lot, and then did The Bourne Identity. The first one.
Mm-hmm.
Which is The Bourne Identity, isn't it?
Yes.
Which is basically a chase movie with a bit of characterization, but is nothing like as good as the Paul Greengrass one, which is The Bourne Supremacy, which is much, much better. Largely, I think, because Paul Greengrass is a really terrific and underrated director. So now Doug Liman is brought in to do the same thing. We want a character comedy, and it's all to do with characters, it's all to do with relationships of these two people. They're boring, they've got an ordinary relationship, but actually, secretly, they're both assassins. Neither of them know about the other ones, and we want that to be the main thing. But obviously, because it's a summer blockbuster, we want everything to blow up all the time. We want loads of car chases, we want rockets, bombs, helicopters. In fact, that's what we want.
We do.
And in the middle of it, we'd like some snappy, sassy, you know, marital dialogue. Let's hear a little bit of it. It gives a perfect taste. This is Brad in a lift that Angelina has wired up with rockets and bombs. Be still, my aching sides.
It's never going to work, honey. It's never going to work because you constantly underestimate me.
Do I?
You have no idea who I am. You have no idea what I'm capable of.
Well, back at you, baby.
Let me guess. Shape charge on the counterbalance cable, two more on the primary and secondary brakes. Maybe.
He found them. Yes, thank you. Did you also get the base charge of the principal cable? Promise to leave town or I'll blow it.
Yeah, and then it goes on like that. We just might as well fade it out, okay? So, basically, what you get is this character comedy completely blown out of all proportion and surrounded by a bunch of, you know, bunch of explosions and a bunch of car chases, which are all directed very loud, very in your face, very sort of zip, zang, boom. And then this other sort of constraining narrative in which Brad and Angelina talk to the camera as if they're talking to a marriage guidance counsellor. Now, I don't know what the production history of this movie is. I know that the original script started, this guy, Simon Kinberg, wrote the script as his master's thesis at Columbia University because he's very interested in Hong Kong films. And he wrote this thing that he said it was a thesis on how marriage is actually like a war zone. And then, of course, what happened is it went to Hollywood and it got rewritten by umpty-thrumpty different writers, because this is exactly what happens in Hollywood. You give it to a committee and somebody says, we need more of this, and someone says, we need more of that, and somebody says, what about that bit and this bit? And the next thing you know, the germ of the idea has completely disintegrated. And all you have is a load of shouting and huffing and puffing and hot air. And it looks to me like this has been extensively reshot. And at some point, somebody has, you know, said, no, hang on, we need that thing that they have in, from When Harry Met Sally, with the people talking to the psychiatrist about their marriage. We need more explosions and more, you know, helicopter gunships and all that stuff. We need more close-ups of Brad and Angelina pouting, because let's face it, that's what we're paying them to do. And they do. Boy, do they pout. I mean, there is not a shot in the film in which either Brad or Angelina are not looking at the camera going, don't we look lovely? Don't we look? I mean, sure.
Well, they do, don't they? Really?
Well, they do, but on the other hand, it's in a very kind of plastic and an artificial sort of, well, fine, sort of way. I mean, personally, I don't think Angelina Jolie is a great actress. I know that she's won awards. I know that everybody thinks that actually she is a very far. I don't get it with her. I just, to me, it's all mannerisms. She is the classic straight-to-video actress who just happens to be earning millions and millions of dollars. Brad Pitt, on the other hand, I think has got something, but it's not in this movie. And so what they do is they go and, you know, wink and nudge and that stuff, and then there's loads and loads more rockets, and there's more nudging and winking and stuff, and then there's loads more rockets, and then you sit there thinking, we've been here for 90 minutes and this is still going on, and there's no more. And in the middle of it all is Vince Vaughn. Now, Vince Vaughn was actually very good in Swingers, and Vince Vaughn pretty much steals the show in Mr. and Mrs. as the guy who runs the assassin agency for whom Brad Pitt works, and the gag, and it is the one gag, is that he lives at home with his mother. I counted 7 laughs in the film, and I think at least 5 of them were gags about the fact that Vince Vaughn lives at home with his mother. It's not terrible. It's not awful. It's not John Borman. It's just not any good. And at 110, whatever it is, million dollars, you kind of think, sorry, you can do the special effects in post. You can do the, you know, all the, make the stars look more glamorous in post. You can do all that, but the thing you can't do in post is fix the script. And it's got so many fingerprints all over. It just looks like, in the same way as Ocean's 12, it looks like a bunch of bankers sat down and added up the sums. And then they took the balance sheet and they turned that into a script. And then that's what you've got. You can literally see the dial with the money going round the side. It'll make a certain amount of money.
So I've only seen the trailer of it.
You've seen the film.
Well, it just reminded me of Spy Kids.
Yeah.
That whole kind of, we are older people and we have a secret presence and we do secret jobs, but we don't know about it.
But, you know, the difference is that Spy Kids is really funny, and Spy Kids is smart and sassy. And incidentally, Spy Kids, of course, is Robert Rodriguez, who then was responsible for Sin City, which, you know, people have been complaining about morally bankrupt. Actually, I don't think Robert Rodriguez is morally bankrupt. But Mr. and Mrs., it's just nothing. I mean, it is just like...
It's not Mr. and Mrs., that's a TV show.
Mr. and Mrs. Smith.
You have been reviewing the right thing.
Yes, that's right. At the end, they have to remember what colour everyone's toothbrush is. Although, funnily enough, there was a TV pilot in the 1990s starring Scott Bakula as Mr. Smith. And I can't remember who was Mrs. Smith, but they were both spies. They were undercover spies, but the difference was they knew they were undercover spies. And the fact that they were married was the cover story. But it's like, so it's not even original. And, of course, the title comes from a Hitchcock film from way, way back, which was far superior because it's been a Hitchcock film and actually had characters in it.
Andy and Oonel said, saw Mr. and Mrs. Smith last night and walked out of the cinema early. If Mark says anything good about it, I'm turning off the radio.
Well, you see, we're on the same wavelength.
Mark Vine in Dorset. Simon, could you tell your excellent critic that he also takes a damn good picture?
Really? What does that mean?
A friend of mine was in Cannes this year and was walking down the road when he thought he saw someone he recognised approaching him. Unsure, he swung around with his camera to look again and found a certain Mr. Kermode staring back at him just as quizzically. My mate is quite a big, aggressive-looking chap and assumed that Mark thought he was after a fight. There you go. So, there you go.
I have no memory of it at all, but it was Cannes and my mind was somewhere else.
Neil says, Sin City, saw it last night. Excellent. Does Mark have an idea where... does Mark have an idea which scenes were Tarantino's?
Yeah.
Was it the first and the last? The assassin seemed a little disjointed from the rest of the story, even with the rest of the segments. The other scenes did a sort of tie-in. But brutal, Frodo, what have you done?
It's all the stuff in the car, but if you go onto the Internet Movie Database, they'll give you an exact break. It's a very specific thing. It's the stuff in the car. You can see it quite easily.
James says, how could Mark not have been moved by the final scene in Star Wars 3? There were people openly weeping in the theatre that I was in. And on that subject, before you feel as though you need to respond, Vicky in Ely just sorting out the Muppets in Space question, which I set up with. Vicky says, sorry to be a Star Wars nerd, but here you go. Lucas did add Hayden Christensen onto the new DVD version of Return of the Jedi. Sebastian Shaw was in the original version. He played Darth Vader when you see his helmet come off as he dies.
Yeah, fine. Okay, well, there we go. So I've actually seen the version with Hayden Christensen, but he's such a bland nobody that I didn't recognise him.
Could have been
somebody should make a film starring Hayden Christensen and Orlando Bloom and call it Who the Hell Are Those Two Blokes?
It would make a lot of money. So we have a question for the Martin Scorsese DVD of The Aviator. We've got a couple of them, actually. Are you going to set this question?
I've changed the question as well because I didn't like the original one.
Okay, well, you better go out and tell them what the
answer is. No, it's easy. So the question is, The Aviator is a biopic of Howard Hughes, and the question is, what was the other famous biopic that Martin Scorsese directed about somebody who one of the production studio executives said he's a total cockroach?
0500 996 93, mayo@bbc.co.uk, 3:48, Joe Sale.
And if you're wondering what Mark looks like, you are on our homepage at the moment.
And
the top of your head's been chopped
picture.
Off, actually, yes.
No, but it's a picture that was taken like, when I was, you know, a long time ago, and I look like a member of BROSS.
There is that, yes.
Lancashire, M55.
What? So you used to look as though you were in BROSS
as opposed to now,
someone from the Spinners.
Well, I don't
the old guy on the left.
Yeah, that's fine.
In the yellow sweatshirt.
With a flute.
So someone has rung in, by the way, for our aviator competition, thinks it's Raging Bull.
Yeah. Is that it?
Yeah.
So it's all over?
Yeah.
There you go.
So what do you want, what do you need now? We've done a movie which an awful lot of people are going to go and see.
Yes.
And then think, well, maybe they'll be disappointed because they'll think it's like War of the Roses, maybe. It's a resemblance to that. What else is new?
Well, two things which are out, which in a way we should review together because they're kind of connected, and it ties back into what you were talking about before about the legacy of the Vietnam War. Inside Deep Throat and Badass. Now, last week you had Mario Van Peebles on the show talking about Badass, which is his docudrama about the making of his father's film Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, which was this classic blaxploitation movie made in the early 1970s. Melvin Van Peebles had made a sort of studio hit called Watermelon Man. He wanted to make a revolutionary, independent black movie. And in order to get it financed, he had to pretend that it was a skin flick because the unions wouldn't go and, you know, sort of worry about union rates if you were making a porno movie. And he turned out making the film that became the most successful independent movie of the year, which is an incredibly ragged, incredibly strange, incredibly contradictory piece of work, and has a great big cult following. I introduced it on Film 4 some years ago. You can get it now on video. So now along comes Badass, which is Mario playing Melvin Van Peebles, and it's basically a story of how the movie came together, all the fights, all the ruckuses. Let's hear a clip. This is the kind of classic stuff that they had to deal with. They had no money, they had no financing, they basically didn't have a script, and they were doing it on the lam.
Hey, Melvin. The script guy, he says you only got a 65-minute movie here.
Listen, I know what I got. Let him keep track of the shots, okay? I got it in my head.
Cool?
We're all right, brother. Don't worry.
Hey, Melvin. Huh? It's Clyde. He gotta talk to you.
He got arrested.
Who?
Donovan.
What about that attorney? We had a deal, man.
Yeah, let's just say that Financing for this film has been put on the back burner for the foreseeable future. Like the next 5 to 10 years, man.
So, you know, no money, crew completely raggedy, all pulled together from some people working in the exploitation industry, some people who were, you know, independent filmmakers, some people who weren't involved in film whatsoever. And they put this thing together, and it is a very strange, raggedy film, but Badass itself is actually really enjoyable. It's got a great soundtrack. It's very, very affectionate about that period. And obviously, Mario Van Peebles remembers it better than anybody else because he's actually in Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song in a very controversial role in which he plays, he's a 13-year-old, and he plays the young Sweetback. And there's a whole sequence in which he, you know...
You don't need to go into
No, but I'm just saying it's interesting because there is a sort of, you know, strange Freudian thing going on in that movie. But Badass is a very interesting film. Also out this week, Inside Deep Throat. Now, I know this sounds...
You don't need to go into
No,
details.
You do.
You do.
Okay. No, but it's basically... Deep Throat is a very famous porn movie. It cost nothing at all, went on to make an alleged $600 million, although nobody really knows because the movie was kind of part financed by very, very shady characters and was distributed through a strange independent network of checkers and sweepers and people who were really outside mainstream distribution. And there was a brief period in the 1970s in which something happened called Porno Chic, in which everybody who was anybody suddenly went to see a porn film, which had never happened before and really hasn't sort of subsequently happened since. Now, what happens in Inside Deep Throat is that these two documentary filmmakers have got together, I have to say, a very impressive roster of interviewees, which includes Jared Damiani, who directed Deep Throat, John Waters, the cult film maestro, narrated by Dennis Hopper. They also have feminists who talk about what happened to Linda Lovelace after she made the movie. And then, of course, I don't know if you know this, but famously, she then turned her back on it and said that she was forced into making the movie by her husband, Chuck Traynor. Now, I have a kind of slightly personal interest in this because I made a documentary about Linda Lovelace some years ago in which it was just after Linda Lovelace had died, and I ended up interviewing her husband. And she had written two books in which she basically said that he was a really terrible, wife-beating, abusive, horrible man. I interviewed him for 4 hours, and I have to say that at the end of the interview, there was nothing that he had said that convinced me that he was anything other than the way that she had portrayed him. And her story was really terrible. I think she genuinely did have an absolutely rotten life. I think she genuinely was abused. But interestingly enough, she wasn't abused by the makers of Deep Throat. She was abused by her husband, Chuck Traynor, who is now, you know, with his maker. Anyway, let's hear a clip from Inside Deep Throat. This kind of gives you a sense of the lightness of the piece. And it is true that if there is a problem with Inside Deep Throat, it's that it doesn't really get into the dark stuff. But here's a clip.
Jackie Kennedy went to see that. The next week, the gross doubled.
As a sexual revolution swept through society, people took sides in a culture war that was gathering steam. Jerry Damiano joined the fray by swapping his blow dryer for a movie camera.
I loved film. I always did. The only thing you could make was sex films. That was the only thing you were allowed to make. And you made them at a low budget.
Doing hardcore films in those days, the early 70s, was very much like summer stock. It was like, Daddy has a barn, let's do a show.
I mean, that's basically the tone of the film. It's, you know, it's a bunch of talking heads. It's got a sort of post-Boogie Night style soundtrack. It has an awfully large amount of very well-researched archival footage. And it places the movie within the context of the Nixon administration of, you know, America at that particular period, the Vietnam War, Nixon, all that stuff happening. And suddenly this ridiculous cultural phenomenon in which really famous high-profile people, I mean, television presenters, you know, statesmen, senators, were going to see this incredibly low-budget porn film that then actually became a paradigm of the porn industry, a brief moment in the sun, and then ridiculous legal cases. It was numerous obscenity cases. After many years, Harry Reams, who was the leading man, ended up being prosecuted, federally indicted, basically for acting in a movie. Then, of course, Linda Lovelace turned around and said, actually, the whole thing was something that I was forced into doing. And then, of course, Women Against Pornography took a great stand against the film. And there is, within the story of Deep Throat, a very interesting paradigm about American society. And although they don't get right underneath it, they really don't do the very, very nasty stuff that's going on. What they are very good on is the cultural moment, and I did enjoy it. And I say that's not something I find easy to say because I have a very specific take on the story of Linda Lovelace herself, which is that she had a really rotten time, and that isn't something which the movie goes into.
And that her husband was everything that she said.
I think he was. I mean, I interviewed Chuck Traynor, and I think if you've read Ordeal and Out of Bondage, there was nothing in the 4 hours that we spent together that would suggest to me that he was anything other than the pig that he suggested that she was.
And just because I don't remember the chronology, Deep Throat in the week that we've actually found out who it was. This movie you're talking about was named after.
Basically, what happened was.
So the movie came first.
Yeah, and it's very interesting because what happened? Deep Throat came out. Nixon had this kind of great new moral leadership thing in which he wanted to sort of, you know, outlaw all pornography. And Deep Throat became a thorn in his side, effectively. When the Woodward and Bernstein investigation into the Watergate thing took off, they had an informant who, theoretically, at first, they only ever spoke to on the telephone. Then, of course, you know, later on, they met in the car park. And recently, that guy has been outed. But then the name Deep Throat was given to him by Woodward and Bernstein, partly because he was somebody who apparently had a deep voice, but also partly because they knew that Deep Throat was this ridiculous cultural phenomenon that was a particular thorn in the side of the Nixon administration. Now, obviously, because I am obsessed with the Nixon administration, I find all this stuff fantastically interesting.
As opposed to other people.
Well, no, but the, you know, the Nixon administration, to me, it's good versus evil, isn't it? You know,
Well, you're entitled to your opinion.
Okay.
So the question for our Raging Bull DVDs, again?
Haven't we done it?
No, give us the question.
Okay, well, it's the Aviator DVDs. Yes. Raging Bull is the answer to the question.
Yes.
And the question was, Martin Scorsese made one other biopic about somebody who the studio executives famously said he's a complete cockroach. What was the film?
Is it Raging Bull?
It is Raging Bull.
Oh, right, okay. And our winners, Reverend David Muldrum in Upminster and Carlo Ortu, who sounds as though he should be in Star Wars, but actually he's in London. Gareth says, saw Mr. and Mrs. Smith last night, thoroughly entertaining, far more than six laughs, very funny throughout.
No, seven laughs. I didn't say six laughs, I said seven laughs. Five of them are Vince Vaughn laughs. There are seven altogether.
John in Sheffield, so Mark thinks Sin City is okay. Well, I don't care how fantasy the violence is. Any film with a poster ad showing each character brandishing a huge gun and claiming to be the coolest film of the year leaves me very worried about the sort of world Hollywood and Kermode want us to live in.
It's a cartoon caricature, apparently. And, you know, honestly, if I was to start getting morally worried about all the vacuous films that are taken seriously. I mean, for at least Sin City knows what it is. Nobody could go and see Sin City and think that what we're talking about is real violence. In a week that something like Inside Deep Throat comes out, or Badass comes out, which has got an awful lot of stuff about it, about the political mistreatment, you know, of people in America, I think that's something to take much more seriously. Sin City is a comic strip. Literally a comic strip.
Movie of the week.
Well, I would say it's tied, and it is Inside Deep Throat and Badass. They both deserve to be seen, and although I have reservations about both of them, they both demonstrate that there is more to cinema than just consumer product.
Mark,
here endeth the lesson.
Thank you very much indeed.